Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Campus-related crime is in the news a lot these days. Last week, Ohio State issued an alert after an armed robbery in a campus building. That came after a string of robberies in the university area that resulted in campus police issuing 5 alerts in November alone. How does the news reflect reality, and how are law enforcement officials responding? Joining us now to talk about that is OSU Police Chief Paul Denton. Welcome to the show, Chief.
Thank you, Ann.
A committee was established after that spurt of off-campus robberies to look at ways to improve safety for students off-campus. And they made some recommendations, and one of them was for the university to spend more money on off-campus safety. So I was wondering, what are we talking about there, and how much money are we talking about?
The amount of money is going to be determined by the senior members of the cabinet and on the committee. But what's great is that we're working with students. It's really a student-led initiative on what direction a lot of that will take. We've got undergraduate representatives. We have graduate students, professional college representatives. All are weighing in with respect to their own needs and perspectives in terms of off-campus and university district issues.
What kind of pattern is there to the crime that informs a committee like that, that drives them in one direction or another?
We look at crimes both on and off campus. First, on campus, two of the robberies that we attributed were actually occurred on university property. It would be under our responsibility as university police. And then the rest were off campus in the university district. We looked at different patterns: location, suspect descriptors, time of day, whether the victims were male or female, and what was taken, and the method of operation, the MO of the perpetrators, to give us some indication that an alert or multiple alerts might be needed during that month.
Was there a pattern to any of it, or was it all random and different and unpredictable?
We depend on Columbus police investigators and administrators to guide us in that, and they said there was no pattern, but there was a series of robberies that occurred, I guess, regularly and more than a routine.
My guest is OSU Police Chief Paul Denton. He's with us today for just about 10 more minutes. So if you have a question or comment for Chief Denton, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, last week when I spoke with OSU President Gordon Gee, I was a little confused, and I wanted to clarify what sorts of how campus police are armed for their jobs, and what the extent of their job entails.
All of our officers are fully certified, trained peace officers in the state of Ohio, which means we have the authority and the ability to enforce Ohio law, to make arrests, and we are trained in firearms and to carry firearms as well. All of our officers are armed peace officers. Our jurisdiction is any property owned by the university, which includes technically the island at Lake Erie to the south centers in Pike County. We have officers stationed not just here in Columbus, but at the Newark campus, Marion, Mansfield, and at Worcester. And those are our jurisdictions as well.
And so when it comes to student safety, one of the things that they were talking about spending more money on is the escorts that take students to and from campus, I guess, at night.
That's correct.
How often is that used, and how much does a ride cost the university? What does that cost?
That program, the Student Safety Service program, is managed under the police division in the Department of Public Safety. We have one full-time coordinator, but those are student employees. It's a program for students, run by and managed by student managers working with the coordinator to run that program. They perform ride escorts in the wintertime. Now we back up to 6 p.m. to about 2 or 3 a.m., and those are student rides. We're at capacity, or as close to capacity as we can do on every one night. People do call hours and sometimes regularly days in advance to schedule their rides. There's no cost to the rider whatsoever, and they can to make use of that. A lot of people do. We rarely, we do take foot escorts or escorts from building to building, but most people prefer riding in a vehicle. And we go on and off campus in a university district to within certain limits.
Does it work sort of like what you would think of as like a cab company works?
We see it as a ride of last choice or an alternate choice. It's not set to replace the public transportation or taxi services. This is an escort for people that feel that they need have a safety need or have no other alternative to get from place to place. And so that's a safety element. That's what makes this different than a taxi service.
And it doesn't cost the rider anything, but does it cost the university anything?
Yeah, they do have a budget and roughly in the $200,000 per year range to do that 12 months out of the year. So we do it all across the entire calendar year.
David in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, David.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. The criminals, of course, don't take any gun safety courses or register their weapons or practice target shooting. But people who have valid gun carry permits, such as a concealed carry permit, take these courses and practice this stuff. They understand gun safety, very similar to the police. What's the situation with concealed carry on campus?
Well, we are sworn by oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States, the laws and ordinances of the state of Ohio, and the rules of the university. And I appreciate that call because I do uphold the Second Amendment to the Constitution as part of my oath of office. However, the university rules prohibit concealed carry on campus, as do restrictions in the state law for the permit holders. Student code of conduct has limitations. And interestingly, when you look at the prohibited places for concealed carry permits, such as mental health facilities, police stations, child care facilities, places of worship that can also limit concealed carry, all those are places that exist on this university. I just don't feel that personally, as a police administrator, as a peace officer, that and as a the chief of this university, I don't think that adding more guns to this campus would make it a safer place.
Thank you, David. Ahmed, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Ahmed.
Today, I really appreciate the issues. I live in Wineland Park, which is a very, very large of the criminal element of the campus area. Kind of resides in Wineland Park. It's the southeast part of the campus area. Mm-hmm. And I was just wanted to ask the chief, you know, we need a little more effort in Wineland Park and maybe perhaps coordinating a like a neighborhood watch groups, because, you know, it's not going to be on one agency. There has to be cooperation between some of the residents and the civic. I also belong to the Wineland Park Civic Association. Mm-hmm. So there's got to be some kind of, you know, collaboration between the residents and the civic, and to create some kind of neighborhood watch group and to see how we can kind of keep an eye on the criminal element that kind of flows around this area. Thanks about that.
Chief Dutton?
Yeah, I'm very familiar with the Wineland Park neighborhood. I spent 28 years with the Columbus Police Division before joining the Ohio State University Police. And we work closely with the Columbus officers that serve that neighborhood. There's some outstanding officers, and they are attentive to crime issues. I absolutely agree that that police cannot do it alone. It is a partnership that with the community members, with police officials, with city officials, that will absolutely make a community safer.
Now, one of the proposals from that committee was to create an official relationship and allow university police to patrol in some city neighborhoods. Is Wineland Park one of the ones you're thinking about?
That's a possibility. We have two programs that exist now separate from that committee, mm-hmm. and the work of what the committee's recommended. One is a joint patrol unit. We have an OSU officer that works a permanent assignment with a Columbus peace officer. They have a specially marked vehicle that was donated to that project and program by undergraduate student government several years ago. And that joint patrol unit does go on and off campus. It does get into the borders of the Wineland Park area, the university district, and serves both OSU property and Columbus jurisdiction to and the students that that live there. You know, they do some proactive policing, they do some programs, and they also do a crime intervention. The other special project is a crime interdiction project that works in the autumn and spring quarters, where we add extra Columbus officers and university officers funded by the university in terms of overtime dollars to allow them to do more visible and in intense crime interdiction during those busy peak times of the year.
Ahmed, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
I was wondering, as far as the joint patrols go, what's the advantage to having a joint patrol versus just beefing up city patrols? What's the advantage of having city and campus police working together?
I'd like to say that we specialize in campus policing. The students are our community. We work with them collaboratively and form relationships throughout the entire academic year. We get to know the students, and they don't just live on campus. As you know, they live within the university district on and off campus. They go to the police agency that they trust. But that is absolutely a possibility, adding more Columbus officers. And I know they've done that in response to this recent crime series, and they've made some arrests, and they've done great work, and they will continue to do great work for that community.
Are there university communities around the country that do combine the forces?
They do have shared jurisdiction in Cincinnati, for example, Cleveland, some of the other Big Ten schools, but the laws are different, and the situation, the circumstances are different. The Columbus agency does a great job for this community, and there are some fine officers that work there.
You're retired from the Columbus Police Force.
Yes, ma'am.
What's the relationship between the city and the university as far as law enforcement goes at this point? What was their reaction when presented with the recommendations from that committee?
I think those things are still evolving through the president's President Gee's safety committee, and we'll see where all that goes.
But otherwise, police and university?
Oh, definitely. You know, we work through all football games, basketball games. The officers get to know each other at the line level, and the administrators. Some of those are my former colleagues and peers that I know personally and professionally. So absolutely the relationship seems to go along, at least as police agencies. And it's not just with OSU and Columbus, but with the entire Central Ohio law enforcement community. I think when you go around the country, and I've talk to other agencies and other administrators, that what we enjoy in Central Ohio stands above a lot of other areas in terms of the relationships, the partnerships, and the collaboration that we enjoy.
You've been on the job here for about 5 years, and you told me earlier that the biggest change since you took the job was, of course, the Virginia Tech murders, massacre. Those years ago, and Virginia Tech popped up in the news again. What happens? I mean, does your adrenaline start shooting when you hear that? And what's the impact on OSU and your job?
We, when we see those situations around the country, we certainly become heightened in terms of our awareness. We do know a lot of the officers that work around the country at other campuses. We keep in touch with them. There's a smaller knit fraternity, if you will, than you would expect in a nation such as ours. But certainly when something happens on one campus, we evaluate our own capabilities, our methods, our ability to handle something similar. We had an officer at OSU that was killed in the line of duty, Officer Michael Blankenship, at our Blankenship Hall is named after the tragedy ourselves. So it touches people in a lot of different ways, and it brings back those memories. There are actually two officers, campus peace officers' names that are etched in the memorial wall at the Ohio Peace Officer Memorial in London, Ohio. And one is Officer Blankenship from The Ohio State University, and the other one is from a community college in the Cleveland area. And so those tragedies do happen. And the one that just happened last week is different from one in 2007, that it was a peace officer that was the focus of that criminal act.
Just real quick, we're running out of time, but I want to ask you about the Buckeye Alert System. That's that text message system you have. How's it working? What do you think about it so far?
There are two messaging systems, mm-hmm. and the Buckeye Alert is our emergency alert system, and it is a system. It involves and includes text messaging as one way, but we go out through email. It can also be through radio and TV interception. We can scroll across the banner on a TV channel here on campus. We can call into office phones. So it's a system of notifications for an emergency. That's when someone has to be notified to take action to preserve their own life or their own safety. And it's not just for criminal acts. It could be tornadoes, okay. disasters, chemical spills, fires, and so forth. The other one is our crime alert warning system. It's a timely warning system, and that name may change depending on the work of the committee. And those are issued by email to alert people when a crime series, such as the one we talked about previously, occurs, and that involves a risk or an ongoing risk to the safety of the community. But it's not as immediate. There's no immediacy with that one because it allows people to plan and evaluate their conduct and behavior. So those are the two notification systems. One's an emergency. One is for criminal action, and I think we got it covered pretty well.
Okay. OSU Police Chief Paul Denton, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me in.
And coming back, we're going to talk about those benchmarks for the city of Columbus. Some good, some not so good. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
New York, Shanghai, Karachi, Mumbai. Many view the world's biggest cities as overcrowded, polluted scars. But as Earth's population ticks past 7 billion, cities may hold the key to sustainable growth. I'm Neil Conan, a special broadcast from National Geographic, Megacities. Plus, scenes from Japan's nuclear disaster. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation is this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 27 degrees in downtown Columbus. Expect sunshine today and a high near 40 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 29. Some more sunshine for Tuesday and a high of 45. And then some rain moving in Tuesday night.
Support for 89.7 comes from Meijer, dedicated to giving back to the community with the Simply Give food pantry program. Meijer will match customers' donations up to $100,000 to help restock local food pantries. More information is at Meijer.com.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Not everything is bad, but the results of a recent survey of community benchmarks for Columbus give serious pause, beginning with the city's dead last poverty ranking of 16 comparable metro areas around the country. Central Ohio also has a lower average household income than most of the areas. The new report titled Benchmarking Central Ohio 2011 gives the Columbus metro area some high marks in other economic and education indicators and lower crime statistics. Joining us today on All Sides is Roberta Garber. She's the executive director of Community Research Partners, the nonprofit group that issued the report with funding from the Columbus Foundation and the Columbus Partnership. She previously served as deputy director of community development for the Ohio Department of Development. Welcome, Bobby, to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Also joining us is Bill Lafayette. He's owner of the economic consulting group Regionomics and a member of the Benchmarking Projects Advisory Group. Welcome back to the show, Bill.
Thanks for having me back, Ann.
Bobby Garber, the introduction to the Benchmarking Central Ohio report says all 16 of the communities you studied have been impacted by the economic downturn with increased unemployment, poverty, and foreclosure rates. But Central Ohio is doing worse on many indicators related to poverty and income and personal property. What's the difference?
I think the difference is, and these are trends that we've noticed over the 4 years that we've done the benchmarking report is that Central Ohio has characteristics of both growing communities and declining communities. We're an interesting mix. I think we're unusual in terms of growing, having a growing population, and unusual in terms of the Ohio and the Midwest. But we also are seeing some of the characteristics of declining communities.
Bill Lafayette, what is benchmarking? What's the value of it to the community?
Well, it's essential to have a comparison not just to the nation as a whole, but to metros that compete with us for economic development, metros like San Diego and Seattle and Austin that we would quite frankly like to be more like. If we understand what's driving those metros, we get a better sense of what we need to do, what our priorities are.
Well, I can tell you right off the bat, I could have told you that San Diego and Austin have a lot better weather. and so how do you account for those kinds of things when you're comparing them, Roberta?
Well, one of the criteria for being able to do benchmarking is that you can have an apples-to-apples comparison. So if you look at the 76 indicators in the report, they all are present data at the metro level. So sometimes people think about this and they say it's Columbus benchmarking, but it's the Columbus metropolitan area, which is a multi-county area. So as we're looking at data, we have to find data you can get at that level and that you can translate into rates or percentages where you can have a similar comparison. So if we find something about weather that can that we can do at that level, that would be great. We do have an indicator of air quality, which has something to do with weather. But there is a focus here on indicators that have to do with the well-being of our community and the economic growth of the community, as well as how households are doing. And most of what we have in the report falls in those categories.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Roberta Garber. She's Executive Director for Community Research Partners. Also, Bill Lafayette. He's owner of Regionomics. It's a local economic consulting firm. And we are talking about the Columbus metropolitan area and how it compares to similar metro areas in the United States. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. A lot of people were surprised at the poverty ranking. We're always told that we're doing better, but that's when we're compared to other cities in Ohio, right?
Right. If you compare just cities, so if you took the city of Columbus, for instance, compared it to the city of Cleveland, the city of Cincinnati, our poverty rates are lower than those. But if you look at the broader metropolitan area, it's higher. So I think one of the things that we surmise is that our poverty is less concentrated, more spread out. And so it's not maybe as obvious, at least particularly to folks who don't live in the older part of Columbus, that there is poverty in our midst, even in the suburban parts of Franklin County and out into some of the surrounding communities.
So, Bill Lafayette, when it comes to what you do, when you look at something like that, when the poverty is more spread out, more dispersed, is that good or bad or just a different set of problems?
It's a different set of problems because you have to have the infrastructure to address the needs of households in poverty. And in a lot of cases, some of our suburban communities and the communities in the outlying counties don't have that much experience with working with individuals in poverty. And so they have to get up to speed.
In response to the report, the president and CEO of the Columbus Foundation said the poverty rate statistics will be and should be a wake-up call to the community about the great and growing needs in the community. On the same token, the community ranked very high in terms of volunteerism and other positive things. What would the community do differently at this point, Roberta? What comes out of something like this when it comes to strategies?
Well, we view the benchmarking report as a tool. We talk about it being like a dictionary, where you can open any page and get information you need. And we encourage folks to look at across the indicators and pull out the ones that are important to them and begin to have that dialogue. So the report doesn't necessarily tell you why these things are happening, nor does it tell you what to do about them, but it is a real resource that we think can be broadly used. And I'll mention just as an aside that we did something different this year that we haven't done before, and that is, in addition to the 16 communities that we compare in the report itself, we've created an Excel spreadsheet that you can download from our website that has all of this data for the 100 largest metro areas in the country. So if you feel like these 15 aren't the right mix for whatever you're looking for, you can look at others. I think we can take this information, first begin the dialogue, and then I think you have to have folks talking about what does this mean to us? Why is this happening? What's the impact on our community? And how do we make use of the things that are really going well in Central Ohio? The growing population, the relatively low unemployment rate compared to many other communities, the economic growth, and leverage that to benefit everyone in Central Ohio. We have strengths that other communities don't have, and the issue is how you put together our strengths with addressing some of the weaknesses or challenges we have.
Bill, the wage average, we have relatively low unemployment, but we still have that poverty ranking, and some look to the wage issue as part of the problem. Do we have are our wages – talk about the wages and what that means to the community.
Well, the wages are lower than average. And kind of the view of the person on the street is that you have low wages because you have a low cost of living. That's what drives wages. That, in fact, is not the correct view. What really drives low wages is low productivity. Individuals make less money because they produce fewer goods and services. And so what you really need to do, I think, to address this issue and several of the other issues that this report points out is a greater focus on training and education. We've got a higher than average degree attainment rate. We're 40% if you count bachelor's and associate's degrees, compared to 35 for the U.S. as a whole. But when you compare us to the 45 largest metro areas in the country, we rank 21st. There are three metros with 50% or more, and even Minneapolis is at 47.
So that's a function of what kind of jobs are here.
In part, it's a function of what kind of jobs are here, and in part, it's a function of what kind of jobs can be here. You need the workforce in order to grow your business. Now, this isn't about college degrees for everybody. Not everybody needs a college degree. Not all jobs require one. But the prognostications for the growth of jobs that require only a high school diploma is really, really bad. So we've got to address that population.
Roberta, when you look at that, well, there are a lot. One thing I wanted to get at, you mentioned that there were some changes this year over last year in the benchmarking process. What other changes were there, and why so many? There, I think it was 16 or 18, something like that.
Well, this we hadn't issued a report for 2 years.
Okay.
There was a year that we took off, and we do work with an advisory committee that Bill and others are a part of, as well as our funders. And each time we've done this, there are some indicators that we drop out because they're not as relevant or the data may not be available. And then we often add indicators. This time we did add 16 or 18 new indicators to the report based on suggestions of our advisory committee and some of the things we found. And the other thing we did is we created a new section to this report called Lifelong Learning. So we've pulled out education indicators that were already in the report and added several new ones. We added a couple of new indicators related to infrastructure, physical infrastructure. We added a couple of new indicators related to status of women. So we think we've broadened this a bit, given us a bit of a new picture, but we still try to keep as many indicators as possible so you can do trending, and we have some good trend data now after doing this for 4 years.
Yeah, the status of women, to what extent does that send a message or suggest any trends?
Well, we actually are doing well in one indicator that we've had in there for a while, and that's women business ownership. We rank second among all the metros in the percent of businesses owned by women. The one where we didn't do as well, let me just make sure that we've got it here. I think we were somewhat lower on a new indicator related to women in as major public elected officials. So we looked at women who are mayors, members of Congress, or governors. That's the figure that's the major officials we looked at. And we ranked lower than some other communities, ranked, I think, 14th in that figure. So I think we have some 12th, sorry. I want to make sure I have the right number. So in some ways, we're doing better on the economic side. In elected major elected officials, didn't rank as high.
Bobby mentioned physical infrastructure bill and infrastructure regarding that. Columbus ranked 13th in the number of highway bridges rated structurally deficient.
Yes.
That's 13 in a bad way.
That is 13 in a very bad and worrisome way.
And so when you're a company looking to move something to Central Ohio, infrastructure matters.
Infrastructure matters for us in some cases more than it matters for the typical metro, because we have distribution and logistics as such a major focus of our economy. And that statistic in particular is one we have to worry about. On the other hand, a statistic that's not in the report and maybe could be is the overall quality of our roads, which is, as I recall, better than average. But roads are one thing. Bridges are something else.
Give me a bumpy road any day over
a
crumbling bridge, right? My guests are Roberta Garber. She's Executive Director for Community Research Partners, and also Bill Lafayette, owner of Regionomics. It's a local economic consulting firm, and we're talking about a benchmark study done 15 metro areas or 16 metro areas, including Central Ohio, and how Columbus compares to those in several different ways. So stay with us. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Michael C. Hall, the star of the Showtime series Dexter, about a serial killer who kills other serial killers. A tricky role for an actor, because the character is always pretending to have authentic emotions.
In a way, it was liberating to let go of that preoccupation. Does this feel right? Does this feel authentic? Am I telling the truth here?
Join us.
And Fresh Air begins later today at noon on 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, a discussion with Julie Zicofus, nature writer, artist, author, and NPR commentator. Anne and Julie will be discussing rescuing and rehabilitating wild birds in Ohio. Join us for that conversation at 11 on 89.7 NPR News. And for as little as $60 per year, you can support our station and get some great benefits, too. As a member at our basic level, you'll receive a member card, a one-year subscription to Newsweek magazine, and electronic versions of our airfare program guide and our e-newsletter. Just visit WOSU.org and click Donate Now. 27 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunny skies today, warming up to a high of 43. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 29. Some sunshine for Tuesday and a high of 45. And then expect some rain moving in Tuesday night. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Today on All Sides, we're talking about a new report comparing Central Ohio with similar communities, well, maybe not so similar communities around the country, to see where we stand in terms of several important economic indicators. Still with us is Roberta Garber. She's the Executive Director of Community Research Partners. That's the nonprofit group that issued the benchmarking Central Ohio 2011 report. And also with us, Bill Lafayette. He's owner of the Economic Consulting Group, Regionomics, and he's also a member of the Benchmarking Projects Advisory Group. You have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Michael in Youngstown, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. My question is this. Within the context of demographics, economic indicators, benchmarks, et cetera, of course, studies are done and in order to reflect what has developed up to this point, up to the present. What is the situation, the status quo? However, how do we utilize these data most effectively for prospective purpose in order to plan ahead, in order for foresight and vision, and creating and implementing, most importantly, a plan going into the future?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, how, for instance, have previous reports been used? Are there any examples?
I think lots of organizations use these in many ways. So we know that this information gets used when groups are doing needs assessments, doing grant writing to raise revenues, and simply to have some picture of what's going on in the community as a baseline going forward. And I think you're exactly right. Any time you do a report like this, you're always dealing with data that's probably 1 to 2 years old, depending on the data source. But, you know, to give one example of an indicator and how it's been used, United Way of Central Ohio, which went through a very extensive process of developing what they call their bold goals and their results indicators, focused on one of the benchmarking indicators around obesity as being something that they want to track. And so there's a case of an organization that's picked that one out, did a lot of looking to say, is this really accurate? And do we want to make an impact on that? And they said yes. And so the fact that we're measuring this every year for them lets us know how the community's doing, and they're targeting some of the resources that they're granting out to organizations to help contribute to changes in that one indicator out of the benchmarking report.
And by the way, Central Ohio is not doing well in that particular indicator.
Right, that's right. We are more obese than most of the other communities.
Michael, thanks a lot for your call.
Okay, thank you very much.
You bet. 614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call and talk with our guests, you're welcome. We're talking about the Benchmarking Central Ohio 2011 report. So the news isn't all bad for Central Ohio. We rank high compared to many metro areas in some other key indicators: economic strength, community well-being, and education. So I thought we could talk about those, the good news. Population vitality, it sounds great. What is it? Could I drink it?
We wish. The population vitality section is really, we talk about this as being more descriptive on some of these indicators. You don't necessarily make a judgment about something being good or bad, but we do know, as we looked at across all of our benchmark communities, that the growing communities tend to have a younger population, a more diverse population. And that's something that where we are kind of in the middle. So we are growing, and you've got communities that we have in the benchmark report that have actually lost population. So we're growing, which is a good thing. Our population is younger, which gives us a good percentage of people who are of prime working age, which is also good. And while we're not as diverse as some of the other communities, if you think about comparing it to places like San Diego, which has a very large Hispanic population, not as diverse, but we actually rank third in the percent of new immigrants in the community. So didn't start out as diverse, but we're growing more diverse more rapidly because of new immigrants entering our community. And we think all of those things give us a good foundation in terms of being able to have a skilled workforce, being able to grow. So it's I think those are looking good in terms of Central Ohio compared to other communities.
And there was that Kids Ohio report that just came out that was, I believe, in the Dispatch this morning, talking about the greater diversity of the suburban schools. And as a graduate of a Catholic high school in Springfield that was amazingly non-diverse, I got a very good education, but I didn't learn to deal with people with different sorts of perspectives. And when you're in business, when you're in the workforce, your customer base, the people you work with, are a diverse lot. And that's something that you really need to learn. And so that is extraordinarily good news for us.
The youth issue, I was surprised at that because we're always hearing about the brain drain. What do we know about those numbers? And have you been able to tease anything out of that that's useful?
We don't. There isn't, interestingly enough, a good indicator or data about brain drain. We are, I think, and I probably should double check before I say this, but I think we are doing fairly well in attracting people into our community that have a bachelor's degree. And so we're bringing some of those folks in, but there's not a lot of data about brain drain. And so I think what we can only look at is what's the characteristics of the population that is here right now, and that is younger than some of the other communities. And we do have a fairly high percentage of adults of prime working age. So I think that's positive for us.
We had a listener on Facebook, Kenneth, wanted to know about air quality and to what extent that is involved in this ranking.
We do have an indicator about air quality, and we actually ranked well on that. We were fifth highest in the percent of days with good air quality compared to the other parts of the country. And, you know, we do have, we rank fairly well in terms of traffic congestion. We have low traffic congestion. So I think there probably is a relationship between those two things. So those are looking fairly positive for us.
I was surprised at a couple things. Charitable contributions. Columbus ranked low on the amount of charitable contributions per tax return, but high in terms of its volunteerism. Mm-hmm. What does that sense? Sort of a mixed message, maybe?
Well, there was an indicator that used to be in there that measured contributions differently. That was what?
Well, this is one where we had to change indicators because the data weren't available that we had in the past. So before, we were looking at charitable contributions per tax return where someone itemized deductions. That for some reason is not available to us from the IRS, so we had to look at it. Charitable contributions are across all tax returns. It gives you a different picture. When we did the previous indicator, we're kind of in the middle. When we do this one, we're at the bottom. And I think it's a beginning of a conversation. So one of the things that people always want to do is kind of make sense across these indicators. Well, this says this, but this says something different. And I think what we have to say is they're all giving you a different perspective on what's happening in the community. And in some cases, they are going to be, if contradictory is the right word, but they're not going to be the same. So, for example, we have fairly high poverty rate, but compared to these other communities, we have a fairly low percent of children getting free and reduced lunch. And that's something that people are going to jump on and say those are contradictory. And I think our response is we got to dive down then on both of those and see if are they really measuring the same things? Are they really contradictory? What do they mean? And I think that's the same as with the other indicators that we've seen, that volunteerism and tax returns are two different ways of looking at our population. And that is the beginning of a conversation.
And so maybe my off-the-cuff thought was that we have lots of people giving small amounts of money and donating their time, but we have a relatively low number of people giving lots and lots of money, which is consistent with the fact that we've got a lower than average number of people at the very high end of the income spectrum. Our 1% here is less than 1%.
Then the other thing is that when you have a community that has a younger population, you're not potentially going to have as many of those big givers.
Right.
But you have people who may want to volunteer. So it may have something to do with the age of the population as well.
Did I read in there that there's less of a gap, though, between the very high-end income and the lower ones? Tell us about that.
Well, I actually took a detailed look at that. Michael's earlier question, the way that I look at these indicators is to sort of pique my interest, to point out something that I wouldn't have looked at otherwise. And so what I did when I saw these two indicators is I looked at the income distribution, and we have 3.2% of households locally earning $200,000 or more. The national average is 4%. And so what's happened is that we've got more people on the low end of the income spectrum, fewer people on the higher end of the income spectrum. So our income diversity is less. But overall, people in Columbus earn less than those in other places.
We're running out of time, so if you do want to put that call in, do it now, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I guess I could just go through all the surprises. Parental employment. Columbus ranked at the bottom with the highest percent of children under 18 living in families where no parent works. Number 16 out of 16. Mm-hmm. That seemed almost shocking.
Hugely troubling.
Yeah,
it is, but one of the things to also look at, so there's the actual number for this year's report, and then we do have trend data, and this was a new indicator, but where we could, if we added a new indicator, we went back the last 5 years to create the ranking trends for Central Ohio. So this one's gone up and down quite a bit. So that's one thing I caution, is that if you look over the past 5 years, in terms of our rank, we've jumped around a lot. So I think that's something we've got to think about, but it is a troubling statistic and, worth diving into as
well. A key indicator of the poverty that we're talking about.
Certainly right. Could be a relationship between that and poverty.
One thing I didn't quite understand was job growth / loss. Columbus ranked near the bottom in job change in manufacturing, 13th, retail trade, 16, and financial activities, 15. What does that mean, Bill Lafant?
This is a long-run indicator. It's measured from 2001 to 2010. And so it incorporates a period, the expansion of the last decade, where we did really, really bad, which honestly I think is part of the explanation for the poverty rate. We had good growth in some sectors during that period. Our retail sector collapsed, but more recently it's done very well. Over the long run, our transportation sector did very well. It's collapsed more recently.
So getting back to the employment thing, Columbus had a relatively low unemployment rate at third lowest. How does that wash with then the numbers of ranking 16 in terms of the highest percentage of children under 18 living in families where no parent works?
Well, you have to look at the unemployment rate in two ways. You have to look at it as potentially driven by job growth and also driven by the change in the number of people looking for work. And our unemployment rate is more than a percentage point below the national average, but for a much greater than average reason, because we've had people drop out of the labor force, ready and willing to work, but just discouraged, don't think that they'll find a job, and for the purposes of that stat, they cease to exist.
Lifelong learning. There was an interesting, it wasn't really surprising given the accolades that have been doled out to our library systems in the past, but we ranked third, I think, in the usage of library.
So.
Second.
Okay.
We've always done well in that one. And we switched that indicator. It was a little bit different last year. I'm not remembering exactly which it was where we were actually ranking first. So we definitely have the whole lifelong learning section, we are really doing well. I mean, if you just look at these each of these sections of the report and say, what's the prevailing sort of picture? The prevailing picture for lifelong learning is good. We're in the top 1 to 5 rankings on almost every indicator. The only one that we're low is adults aged 25 and over with only a high school diploma who don't have any post-high school education. But as I say to people, this is an Ohio issue. State of Ohio has always historically done fairly well getting people through high school, not done as well in terms of adults getting past that high school degree. So that's the challenge we face. And unfortunately, you can't, as Bill said, you can't necessarily get a good job with benefits anymore with just a high school degree. But otherwise, I think we have to be proud of our education indicators here, because I think they are looking pretty good.
Coming up, are you going to do another of these studies next year? What's the plan going forward, Roberta Gerber?
The latest conversation that we've had with the funders is that they would like to do it every 2 years. So, and we got a little off cycle in terms of timing on this. So 2 years may be having something come out the beginning of in the first quarter of 2013. So that we can get the newest data and incorporate that. So we'll know more about that at some point early next year.
Bill Lafayette, is that a useful time period to go every 2 years? Is there an optimum? I mean,
well, I think it's useful, especially given the fact that the data are trended. And so even if a report doesn't come out next year, when it does come out in 2013, we'll have what 2012 data there are. And by then, we will have had the conversations that this report really needs to start us having.
Bill Lafayette, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ann.
Appreciate it. Bill Lafayette, he is a local economic, he owns a local economic consulting firm. It's called Regionomics. And also Roberta Garber. Thanks for joining us, Roberta.
My pleasure.
Roberta is the Executive Director for Community Research Partners. We've been talking about the Benchmarking Central Ohio 2011 report. We'll have a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to learn more about that. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.